I'm not going to say everybody's got a novel in them because.
But like everybody has some, as you said, everybody's
got a haiku in them.
Do you think there's no way I could do a haiku? That's math.
Welcome to Page Count, presented by the Ohio Center for the Book at Cleveland Public Library. I'm your host, Laura Maylene Walter. Today, we're featuring an author I first met in person years ago at a Festivus party in downtown Cleveland. But that's probably a story for another time. Susan Petrone is a Cleveland author whose newest novel is the musical Mazinski's. She recently appeared in conversation with Cleveland Public Library's own Jen Jumba at a Writers Unplugged event at our South Branch. Their conversation was recorded, and we're sharing it with our Page Count listeners today. Susan discussed everything from the thrill of seeing your book out in the world, the unreliability of memory, the power of music, finding yourself in a book, and, naturally, the falafel and milkshakes at Tommy's. Writers Unplugged is presented by Cleveland Public Library and offers both virtual and in-person conversations with authors. Be sure to check our show notes for information about upcoming Writers Unplugged events and subscribe to the podcast version of these recorded conversations. For now, I'll turn it over to Jen Jumba, who interviewed Susan Petrone on February 7th, 2024. Enjoy.
Good evening, and welcome to Writers Unplugged. This is a series and a chance to hear your favorite or new to you writers in conversation as if you were eavesdropping on us in a coffee shop. So my name is Jen Jumba. I'm a librarian at the main branch of Cleveland Public Library. I think one of my favorite things to do besides reading is talking to the people who wrote the books that I read. So it's a chance to get to know their craft. It's a chance to get to know what inspires them, where they like to write, essentially getting to know them better than just the name on the spine of a book. So this evening, we are so lucky not only to be in this beautiful South Campus branch, Carnegie designed, but with Susan Petrone, local writer here, super excited. So before we get started, a couple housekeeping things. If you want to know who else is visiting, if you go to cpl.org and you click on events, there's author visits and you'll be able to see who else is coming. So Max Back's Books on Coventry is here, has copies of Susan's books for you. I'm sure you'll pick them up. She's graciously agreed to sign them when we're done. So brief introduction. Okay. Susan Petrone is the author of The Heebie-Jeebie Girl, The Super Ladies, Throw Like a Woman, my favorite, A Body at Rest, which won a bronze medal for regional fiction from the Independent Publishers Book Awards. Super Ladies was a general fiction finalist in Forward Review's Book of the Year Awards, and she's the recipient of the Ohio Arts Council Individual Excellence Awards. And she's also one of the co-founders and former president of Literary Cleveland. Super cool. So if you've already read Susan's books, then you know these awards are well-deserved. And if you're new to her work, then trust me, you will marvel at her storytelling, her ability to write beautiful sentences, create characters that both annoy you and find a way into your heart and provide such unique glimpses into other people's lives. And on a personal note, Susan is great to have a conversation with, whether it's about books, sports, baseball, travel, or basically any other subject. It's like talking to a friend that you've known forever. So we are so lucky to have you here. Thanks. So congratulations. This is your latest book, the musical Mazinski's, right?
Yeah.
It's barely a month old.
Technically it's three weeks.
So it's like babies, right? You give birth to this amazing thing and we start to measure like in days and weeks.
Yes.
Not pounds though, but no. Amazing book. So I have to imagine writing a book and then seeing it published and seeing it in bookstores and on shelves, that hopefully never gets old.
No, it does not. I mean, short answer, no, it never gets old. There's always that thrill and we go, oh, wait. I know that book. And you're like, for a kid who grew up, actually my first job was in a library,
okay.
Coventry Library over on the east side. And my mom used to co-own a used bookstore. So like hanging around books and bookstores and libraries has always been my thing. And so seeing my book on a shelf in a library or a bookstore is kind of like, it's just like the biggest kick. It's, yeah. I can't even describe it. And sometimes it helps if you're like, if I'm struggling with something that I'm writing, like I'll look and like, okay, I wrote that and that and that. I can do this. Like, you know how to do this. Like, just
absolutely
just keep doing it.
How would you, if you were to pick 5 words to describe this book?
Five?
Five
can
phrases.
They be, like, can they be, like, connected? Like, a five-word sentence? Or do they have to be,
absolutely,
like, 5 individual words? Okay.
Oh, no.
Man. You know, the 2 things that can break your heart, music and family. I didn't come up with that. That's from a really nice blurb that Carter
Bay
wrote.
But it's so true.
But yeah, I love that. So it's 2 things that can break your heart, music and family, and hopefully put it back together.
Yes. Which you did. You kind of broke my heart, but thankfully you helped put it back together.
Yay.
So, the first chapter, we just look at like the first line, which I find to be utterly magical. So you want to read it?
Sure. Tell me how much you, literally just the first sentence?
Yeah, just
okay.
To like what he does with the music.
Okay.
First line. Gets ya.
Chapter 1, Sing for Your Supper. Vincent Mosinski could grab music out of the air. He would reach out, grab the beat, and cup it in his hand as though listening to it for a moment in private. Then he'd shake it, 1, 2, 3, 4, and throw the beat back out into the world for all to hear and for his children to see. Is that all you want me to hear?
Can you tell me a little bit more about the idea of where that came from, like being able to like see music?
And if you go to like the farther on in that paragraph, I mean, honestly, I'm ripping off Charles Schulz a little bit because like in Peanuts, when Schroeder's playing and like the musical notes, the musical staff is above the piano.
Yeah.
I grew up in a family that was very, very musical or very artistically inclined.
Okay.
So there was always music around, and the idea that like you could see music and maybe everybody in a family could see music except like one person kind of felt like a way of manifesting that feeling that many of us have of not really fitting in with your family.
Yes.
So honestly, I kind of just started thinking about that. This started, like a lot of my novels, this started out as a short story that I didn't know what to do with.
Okay.
And I think it started out as something a little more, at the time I started it, I was in a writing group.
Okay.
And like somebody's like, oh, I can imagine this being like this great book, like The Saturdays, which was like, I don't know if you ever read that, like, it's probably like same like vein as like Edward Eger, so probably like YA from the 50s or 60s, but like, you know, a lot gentler and less literary fiction than it turned out to be. It's one of those things. I can't remember the exact moment.
Okay.
That I thought of that, but yes, I did rip off Charles Schulz a little bit.
A little to describe, right?
Yeah.
Because it's if you talk to people who have it's called synesthesia.
Synesthesia. Yeah.
Where they can see notes, they can see colors.
And I think synesthesia is like if you see colors. I'm not sure if there's an actual term, like medical term for seeing notes.
Synesthesia.
Synesthesia,
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, it makes something up, I don't know.
But it helps to connect, to see what you're trying to get people to see, that that's what it looks like. Because almost all of us have watched Peanuts and seen Schroeder play the piano and seen those notes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you talk about your dad being a musician and growing up in a musical family.
Yes.
Is this loosely based? Nobody's listening.
No, that's good. That's and this is interesting because so the musical Mosinski's is about a family of 6 with 6 children, of artistically inclined children, with a jazz piano playing, cigarette smoking father and a violin playing, songwriting mother who holds everything together. And I grew up in a family with 6 artistically inclined children, with a jazz piano playing, cigarette smoking father and a violin playing, songwriting mother who held everything together. So
Write what,
what you know. So it's a little bit autobiographical, but I would say it's less autobiographical and more like a memory book.
Okay.
And a few years back, I heard John Irving speak in Cleveland.
Ooh.
So cool. And he just used the phrase, memory is a monster. And I was like, oh, yes, it is.
Yes.
So, I mean, the things that we think that we remember may not be what anybody else in your family remembers. So I know that I have siblings who'd be like, that didn't happen. Like, it's a memory book. It's not a memoir. It's, you know, it's a novel. So, yes, there are some autobiographical elements. Like, there are some things that happened. I can tell you more about them if you're interested.
So, did anybody in your family, could they see music and experience music
not
the way
that
this family?
Okay. Not that I know of. Not that I know of, but I mean, when I was growing up, there was, and again, this is like, you know, our perception, because memory is a monster, our perception of like reality is probably different than what actually happened. But I remember just feeling like everybody in my family could play an instrument well, except me. And there was like, I went through this period of like, you know, trying out my sister's flute. Or, you know, then there was the great, you know, French horn debacle of fourth grade, which was, and I finally ended up playing clarinet for a little minute. Was not a fan. Do you play clarinet or the French horn? Okay. I really wanted to play the saxophone. And my dad's like, and my dad really did do the, well, if you learn how to play clarinet, then you'll learn to play saxophone. It'll be easy. I'm like, I don't have the desire to play this.
Yeah.
But there was that feeling that everybody could do this and I couldn't. And I felt like there was like some genetic switch that had been flipped on everybody but me.
So my guess is you can write and none of them can write.
No, that's not true, actually.
Oh, that's what I was going.
Right? No, when you grow up in a large family, like there was a time when I was like maybe 7 or 8 and I looked around, I'm like all the cool activities are already taken. Because like, you know, one sister was sang and, you know, took voice lessons, and another one played flute and wrote poetry, and then another one was saxophone player, and then another one was an actor. And then there's my brother Mike, who's still a full-time jazz piano player, and then there's me. So it's like all the cool activities have, you know, been taken. I mean, the nice thing about growing up in an artistic family is that it did normalize creative pursuits.
Absolutely.
Like, the first time I had a play produced, like 3 other people in my family had already had a play produced, so that wasn't like a weird thing.
Yeah. I mean, it normalized it. Yeah.
It was weird in my family if you could do calculus.
Oh, okay.
See, so like by some standards I fit in.
Absolutely.
By that standard, I totally fit in.
Yeah. So I'm in the beginning of the book. You're talking about Vincent and Grace. So like the
pairs.
Jazz playing, cigarette smoking. Father, and the violin playing,
songwriting
mother who holds it all together.
Yes.
And they're talking about family, and there's a question about teaching music to children, right? And there's a line where you talk about, some people think you shouldn't just start music lessons until the child can read. You aren't fighting 2 learning battles at once.
Yeah.
And the response was, music isn't just an intellectual exercise, it's a deep part of being human.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not something you learn, it's something you feel that everybody feels. And I think all of us listening and all of us in this room can think about a particular piece of music that every time you hear it, it gets you. Or every time it's on, you find yourself singing along to it. So, you know, can you think of a piece of music where, you know, when you were growing up that you just felt?
Oh,
I mean, it's a 70.
So many.
I know, so many.
Not really so much like when I was growing up, but I will say, okay, not my Desert Island Discs,
okay,
which I think is a different thing,
absolutely.
But like the songs I want played at my funeral,
okay,
would be Morrissey, Sing Your Life,
ooh,
Lyle Lovett, In My Own Mind, and probably Ricky Lee Jones's version of I'll Be Seeing You.
Oh.
But those are more lyrically than...
Yeah, because songwriting tells a story
through
music the way you tell a story through the pages in your book.
Exactly.
So, and if people like you really good at the craft, it gets you right here, whether it's music or writing. Right here.
Right here.
So I'm joined in conversation this evening with local writer Susan Patrone. So let's talk a little bit about the children and and their ability and how they don't just play one instrument. Can you kind of introduce us to like this cast of characters?
So the Mazinski family has six children. The eldest is Clara. And yes, they all have musical names. So Clara plays the harp. And, you know, the family mythology is that when she was very small, because she has long, curly hair, and her parents were like, Clara has the look of a harpist. Where, so that's like the family mythology, and the parents are always good at matching up children with instruments. And then you do learn later that it's like, no, some music department at some college was cleaning out their, having a fire sale on instruments, and they got a troubadour harp, and... So, but Clara is kind of, she's the your quintessential oldest child.
Yes.
Just, she's responsible. She does what she's told. Mm-hmm. Until she doesn't.
Yes. Which is
great. Yes. The second oldest and the oldest boy is Ellington, who is a percussionist through and through. If he's kind of like Manny Ramirez, like if Manny Ramirez couldn't hit a baseball, I'm not sure what he would be doing. If Ellington couldn't play. If Ellington had no rhythm, I don't know what he'd be doing. He's kind of a mess. He's a he's like a lukewarm mess, not even a hot mess.
Yeah.
The next is Bix, who's just Mr. Sunshine.
Yeah.
And also is ends up being the front man, kind of by default when they have a band when the kids are like in grade school. But he's the one who ends up on like the cover of Tiger Meat magazine because he's just adorable. He's got all the curly hair.
He has the curly hair and the
brown eyes. You can swim in. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So that's Bix, and he's just, you know, maybe spends a little too much time making everybody love him. Then the next is Allegro, who is probably the one in the family who's not only a musical prodigy but also just borderline genius.
Yeah.
Kind of doesn't hate everybody, but she does get, she has not, she does not learn patience for people who might not be her intellectual equal. So that's Allie, and she's, you know, she's wonderful. I love her. The next is Thelonious, Theo, who's, when they're small, realizes that he's kind of like the bench player, because so whatever kid leaves, you know, he's going to have to replace somebody, so he learns, like, all the instruments. But he's, Theo is just, he's kind of not quite the lost boy, but he's kind of, he has his own thing that kind of separates him and others him from the rest of the family. And then the youngest is Viola. And it's not a secret to say, because it's on the back cover, the problem is Viola is tone deaf. So she's the one in the family who doesn't see the music, and not only that, really just couldn't carry a tune if it had a handle, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's one of my favorite
the old line. So those are the kids.
Makes me think about when I was growing up. My parents are amazing and wanted me to have all kinds of opportunities, and they encouraged me to take piano lessons. I cannot read music. Like, if you show it to me, I can do the every good boy does fine and face.
F-A-C-E, yeah.
Right? Like, I know that, but I could not read it. And my parents are like, once you make a commitment, you follow through on that commitment. So you're in it till the recital. Oh, come on. Oh, yeah, no way. I just memorized it. Like, I cannot.
You played it by ear. Yeah.
I could not read it to save my life. But I loved being around music. And when I was in high school, I was in the chorus. I'm tone deaf. Cannot sing. Not even in the shower, in the car, on a sunny day. However, I just wanted to be around it, so we had an agreement. The choral instructor and I, like, you just lip sync everything.
Oh my God!
But I wanted to be surrounded by the music and all the different parts.
Aww.
I know, kind of pathetic.
But no, it's not. It's really sweet, and I love that you were there.
But music is an amazing thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of transcends language.
Yeah. Well, and okay, like. We all saw the clip from the Grammys with Tracy Chapman and Luke Combs doing Fast Car. Oh my, like every time I cry.
Absolutely.
Because it you just you like two generations, like different genders and different races and different gender and generations. And we all are connected. Like coming together and like seeing the crowd at the Grammys and people singing along and just feeling those lyrics. And that's one of the magic of music, that it can bring people together from so many disparate places and groups, and we all find a home in it.
Yeah.
Oh, I kind of feel bad about you and the choir, but
it's okay. Yeah. We had an agreement because I could not sing.
That's
awful. I mean, I can't even talk cool very well, but so it's a whole different story.
That was really kind of cool of him that he did that, mm-hmm. that he made that agreement with you.
Mm-hmm.
I can read music, or I can count I can't do both at the same time.
Yeah.
I can play it by ear. Like,
that's
I can
impressive.
Learn it, yeah, right? Like, I can learn how it's supposed to be, but I'm never like counting. Like, I know that whole note's worth four beats.
Right, exactly. And that half note's too. Like,
yeah,
I mean, I knew all that stuff. And
you're making me do math while this trying to do that, and
calculus,
it just doesn't work.
Right.
Exactly.
See, if only it were calculus, you'd be all right. Right. So I'm joined in conversation this evening with local writer Susan Patrone. So families in themselves have these very interesting dynamics, right?
Yeah.
This story, the musical Mozinski's, which is like about 3 weeks old, takes it to another level, because not only are they families, but they're performers.
Yes.
So then that kind of takes it up, and they're performing in front of a live studio audience.
Yeah.
So I had to laugh at one point when Allegro says, like, the only way to stop one fight is to start another.
Yep.
Because there's constant tension with the cigarette smoking, jazz piano playing father.
Yes.
And what he wants to do versus what the kids want to do.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that tension captured in the book?
Yeah, that's, I think that the, you know, Vincent, the father, is kind of a product of his time, and he realizes, okay, my kids can make money, and like, we're successful because of them. And people like the bubble gum, so that's what we're going to give them. And like, if you remember like the musical variety shows of the 70s, mm-hmm. like they were wacky. Like everybody had a musical variety show in the 70s.
Absolutely.
I mean, like you had like big, huge name stars like Julie Andrews and Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, weirdo people like Jim Nabors and Engelbert Humperdinck, and people that you've never heard of since. Like, I'm looking at you, Humbert Brothers, Tony Orlando and Don. Like, you don't remember any of those.
Yeah.
They were, and just, this is, if you need an example of just how wackadoodle the 1970s musical variety shows were, and like, this was kind of my inspiration of like, how bloody embarrassing it probably was for them, is, when we're done here and you go home, go to a safe place around people that you trust. Go to YouTube and search for Brady Bunch and Car Wash.
Oh.
Please, I don't say I didn't warn you.
Everybody's taking notes in the audience.
Brady Bunch and Car Wash. So, I mean, using that as your benchmark, yes, there's going to be a lot of tension because, you know, they don't want to sing the same kind of things, and they don't want to wear the ugly costumes, and they want to play what they want to play. And as they develop more of their own musical taste, like we all do,
right,
they start diverging a bit from their dad, and the dad's like, no, we're gonna do this. And
have some moments where they they stage a coup and kind of overthrow what dad wants them to do on live television.
They do, and then he gets in trouble for it.
Yes.
Yeah. And eventually there is a real break.
Yes.
But, you know, there ain't no accounting for taste, right?
No, that's
so
true. And that's when I learned, like, the Partridge Family, that's not real. None of them could really sing.
No, like two of them.
Yeah, but like, well, David Cassidy.
Yeah,
but, yeah.
And Susan Day could kind of sing, but like, they make fun of the Partridge Family because,
Yeah.
Yeah. I would, if I were the Mosinski kids, I would make fun of them.
Absolutely. And I think it's just, I think it's interesting when you think about the kids that they grow up basically on a television set. They have show school is what they call it. That they don't go to school with kids their own age.
Right.
The older ones started, and then
the
once
older ones started.
They were, you know, father recognized and mom recognized that they were talented, decided to start this show. But like, not to go to school with your own peers, like that's got to be hard and awkward and everything else in between.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's, you often hear of all the, you know, these child stars who grew up and have all sorts of problems. Wonder why, you know, because you have tutors on set and you don't actually get to be a normal kid.
No, you don't. And there's even like a scene in the book where Bix and Ellington decide like they're going to go ride their bikes and kind of see about the local kids at the school down the street.
Yeah.
And it does not end well.
No, it does not.
Again, broken heart.
Sorry.
It's okay. Put back together at the end. It's okay. So stay with it. So this book is just incredible, right? The insight
Thank
and the
you.
Glimpse into how it must feel to be performing, how they're balancing, how they're figuring out what their own tastes are. You know, as you grow up, you realize you don't always like the same thing your parents do.
Yeah.
Typically hits 12, 13-ish.
Yeah.
I would say younger these days, knowing my nieces, but because they don't listen. So I found that really kind of interesting that you were able to capture that it wasn't all perfect, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes books are perfect and characters are a little flat, but they're complex. They're trying to figure out how to work with each other, trying to figure out how to work within a set, with parents, with managers, you know, with money.
Yeah. We so often get the, you know, that pretty picture of, you know, oh, look at the Carpenters, they're great, and the Jackson family, they're great, and then you, boy, they're really a mess behind the scenes. So I kind of wanted to explore that a little bit more, not in the, you know, sensationalistic way that you get with, like, you know, the Karen Carpenter story or Michael Jackson or any of those people who were, like, rightfully messed up by what happened to them.
Right.
I mean, but, you go back to, like, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland when they were teenagers of just trying to find out who they were, because once you have something, you know, once the system has something that works,
you keep
milking it, no matter if that kid's 13 or 18. We'll make them look 13.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah, to me, I find it incredibly fascinating that you're able to kind of capture that duality, right? That, you know, some stuff about being, you know, child stars and on a show is really kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then there's also like a flip side. So
yeah,
could be dark, but
I mean, I sometimes I go dark. I don't go too dark. I just, whenever I write something, even if I'm trying to write something serious, like I end up putting a joke in, like I can't help it.
Yeah. The only way to stop a fight is to
start
another
one. Yeah.
Can't
or
carry
tell
a tune
joke.
Unless it had a handle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just absolutely fun. So I'm joining conversation with local superstar writer Susan Patrone. Talk a little bit about their dad.
Oh, amazing.
And, you know, he's like larger than life, right? He had a great, you know, somewhat career, you know, starting.
Yeah.
But then it just became defined by his kids, you know, and choosing instruments and pieces.
He liked to have... I mean, he wanted... Vincent's very talented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the book, when they start out, they are in Cleveland. So, like, most of my work, it at least starts in Cleveland. It's based here because this is, you know, the place I love and I know. So Vincent, greatly talented, just never quite gets the break that he thinks he deserves.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his friend Gregor Karpenko, who becomes their manager. They come up with a lot of schemes. They never seem to work out to advance Vincent's career. And then the kids record a commercial for a local car dealership. And for whatever reason, it's like, that's the commercial that everybody in Cleveland is singing that spring. Like, it just, people are like, oh yeah, like that. I like that song. I like that little, and like, that gets them noticed.
Yeah.
And then they go on a show that's... Do you remember the Gene Carroll show? Right? Okay, so they go on a show that's like a local televised talent show that they then they start getting recognized, and Vincent realizes that his path to his dreams mm-hmm. is going to be through his kids.
Right.
And he could be more, I mean, he's not like super cutthroat,
mm-mm.
but he's not empathetic, let's say.
I was going to say open to suggestions.
No, not open to suggestions, not the most empathetic guy.
No. So you just mentioned, you know, your book, Cleveland features
yes.
in the book, and it was super fun. You talk about Kane Park, right,
yeah.
which is just a treasure that we are yeah. so lucky to have. You talk about Tommy's. I mean, who doesn't love Tommy's? And I'm thinking of Max Bax right next
yeah.
door, right?
Yeah, I name dropped Tommy's a lot, and I've name dropped it in Body at Rest also.
Okay.
I think every book I name drop a restaurant that I like.
Okay. So do you have like, I've been there several times. Mm-hmm. I don't see like a Susan special. Like
no,
there
not.
Should be if you're dropping the name, right?
But
you should have a milkshake named after you.
No, that's cool. They don't need to, but it's because it's named for like people who used to work there.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the Cape Town special was from my sister Nikki, who used to work there, and her then boyfriend, later husband, was working as a volunteer in Lesotho.
Yeah.
Since nobody knows where Lesotho is and it's completely surrounded by South Africa,
yes.
then they, and my sister Nikki had the idea of putting raisins into the spinach pie. So the Cape Town special
nice.
Is wasn't.
I'm
was
thinking like
created.
A heebie-jeebie special would be really good. I mean, musical Mosinski, I get, yeah.
Okay, the heebie-jeebie special. I don't know. Maybe
it's kind of, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, like a falafel maybe, like
yeah.
the falafels.
Absolutely. That's normally what
I'm
I get when
so
I'm there.
I'm so hungry now, right?
I know, seriously. I'm thinking about falafel and the cookies and cream shake
and
the peach shake. I can never make up my mind.
Oh, yeah, the peach shake.
So can you talk a little bit about the birthday solo tradition that appears in this book?
Okay.
It's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, because you know how every family has a way of, like, torturing people. you know, happy families are all alike and unhappy mm-hmm. families are unhappy in their own way. So the Mosinski family unique way of torturing people is every year on your birthday, you get to perform.
Mm-hmm.
You get to perform in front of the rest of the family. You know, many songs you want to do, as many instruments as you want to do, you gotta nail it
mm-hmm.
because, you know, people like Allegro and Ellington will make fun of you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you grew up in a large family, you know, large families are really good at, you know, we don't hurt faces, we hurt feelings. So that's definitely, they're Gen Xers. That's what they hurt. So the birthday solo then becomes a thing on the show because it's a way of, you know, like, okay, let's put it this way. Like, who here can identify any of the Osmonds besides Donnie? Nobody. Like, you're like, that guy with the teeth and the hair or that guy
with
like the
teeth. Oh, it's like Menudo. Like, I only knew the one.
Were they related?
No.
Oh, okay.
But
you
had me at group and hair and only
yeah,
knew
right.
That.
So, yeah. So the producers are like, oh, they should do the birthday solo on there because the focus group say that they can't always identify which kid is which, so they start doing the birthday solo mm-hmm. on the show. So, you know, the only kindness with the birthday solo is that you don't have to start doing it till you're 8. So each time one of the kids on the show turns 8, then they get a birthday solo and they get to perform. And on the show, and they get to do their solo, and there's a lot of pressure for an 8-year-old. You know, there are some people like Allegro, who's like, I'm playing Paganini, damn it, you know.
Yeah.
And others, like Viola, for whom it's not pleasant.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about Viola and how she experiences music differently?
I don't know if I want to give away too much.
Okay, that's fair.
Is that
yeah.
cool?
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know some people here have read it, so I don't want to, you know.
No,
you
that
know,
I
but
just...
But some people haven't.
So the other thing that I'm struck by is, yes, this is a musical family, so not like the family I grew up in,
mm-hmm.
but the universality about wanting to fit in.
Yeah.
And how that... how it's important. And I think it's with us our whole lives. And I mean, yeah. we're all grown adults here, but I think we all still want to fit in wherever we go. And you really capture that well in this book with the characters and the family and the tension and
Thanks.
Just how important it is to kind of find your, yeah. find where you fit.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said earlier, seeing the music, I realized that was a really nice way of like, kind of like a, not a physical manifestation, but a way of manifesting how apart Viola feels from the rest of the family. Like,
yeah.
everybody in the family can do this but me.
Right.
But there are other characters have other aspects to their personality to their identity.
Right.
That also kind of separates them from the rest of the family. And right. maybe that's a little bit more hidden. For them, or it doesn't come out, but they all, I think at some point, everybody feels like they don't fit in their family of origin.
Absolutely. I think it's just part of being human,
yeah.
right? And then
yeah.
it makes me think, like, well, what if we just talked a little bit more about it, right? Instead of feeling so isolated or so...
Ew, talk about our feelings, ew.
I know.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. But, no, absolutely. But it's hard because we are so often presented with this, you know, the Facebook, Instagram, everything's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at my TikTok video, look how cute my kids are. Like, mm-hmm. they are.
You don't see the fact that they just drew with, like, Sharpie all over the wall. And,
right.
You know,
and
the ones running around half naked and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, who hasn't done that?
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
We should talk about it more. We should talk about
yeah.
that feeling isolated because every family has, even if it's a family of like two, every family has its own weird little dynamic and
Absolutely.
You have your own traditions. And if you don't fit into those or if you hate them, somehow there's something wrong with you.
Yes.
If you don't like the tradition or you want to change
yeah.
it.
Yeah, or you follow a career path because you thought that's what you were supposed to do because your parents do it.
Right.
Until you grow up and you realize, I want to be a librarian.
Talking about a friend, yeah.
Talking for a friend.
Yeah. No, but that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. But I think that's, like, parents, you know, you kind of want to expose kids to lots of different things to try to figure out where they fit, but there's, like, no opportunity. It's, like, all music all the time. Like,
yeah.
They're always
that's
playing. That's their job, but, like, there's no downtime. Like, we have, like, in school, you know, you have, like,
yeah.
summer breaks or spring breaks. No, that's when
they're
touring.
It.
They don't get that. It's just nonstop grind from a very early age. And
yeah.
it's hard.
I think so. And I think we do people a disservice when we demand, like, from entertainers and performers, like, more, 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 more.
Oh, absolutely. Or even if you see them outside of that setting, like,
yeah.
you expect them to... You know,
yeah.
be that, like, you're just going grocery shopping.
We
or
don't
you're going
own,
through the airport.
Yeah.
Like,
we don't
just
own
a
celebrities.
No, but we think we do.
Yeah.
It's an interesting yeah. dynamic because you feel like the people on TV, you know, and a
right.
lot of this book, like the birthday solos weren't really always on their birthdays.
Of course not.
It was kind of when ratings and when they
yeah.
needed a push or for the season to get picked up again.
Yeah.
But there's this weird dynamic. You see somebody on TV, you think, oh, I know them.
We don't. Oh, the littlest Mozinski's growing up. Oh,
exactly.
Yeah. It's like, well, when we do that, and I mean, you know, there's still a part of me, I'm like, well, yeah, the Kelce brothers, they went to my high school. I'm like, they went to my high school, like, way after I graduated. You know, there's still a part of me, I'm like, he should bring her to Tommy's.
Yeah.
And they should come to, all the Swifties are like,
exactly.
they should come to Cleveland.
That's exactly right.
But we feel like we know them.
Well, and that's just it.
I am convinced that, like, Stephen Colbert and I would be best buddies if we met. We
Fair.
Totally would.
Yeah.
I mean, totally.
Absolutely.
Totally.
Same sense
because,
of humor.
Because we know, because we feel like we know him.
Right, and that's the thing that's, to me, it still kind of amazes me. That
yeah.
we just don't know people, anybody. Like,
no, but we do invite them into our house.
Exactly.
Every, you know, every day, every week, whatever.
Yeah. And yet, there's still the... What's being portrayed
yeah.
on TV is not always what was real.
Correct.
So, joined in conversation with local writer Susan Petrone. So the other thing I think that's great about books is how important it is to find yourself in a book.
Yeah.
And to feel like you're not alone, right? And I think books for a lot of people are comfort. And I think about all the people that are going to read this book that maybe they don't have a family of musicians. Maybe it's a family of writers or a family of teachers,
lawyers,
or attorneys, whatever it is, and feel like they don't fit in, and how much comfort they'll take from seeing Viola and how things evolve for her and her family.
I hope so. I mean, that's, I mean, novels are, novels give us a glimpse into other people's lives, and I mean, reading teaches us empathy and compassion, and that's how you travel.
It's
without leaving, you know, without leaving your house, you read a book, you
absolutely
can travel everywhere.
You mentioned one of my favorite books in this book.
Which one?
From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E.
Frankweiler.
One of my absolute favorite books of all time.
Great book.
And to see it referenced in here, I was like, ah, see, Susan and I would be great friends.
We
I just
are,
know it.
And we are.
Absolutely. The other thing in the book we'll talk a little bit about is decisions. You know, we all have them, right? And sometimes we choose one thing. Mm-hmm. It ends up hurting somebody else at the same time.
Yeah.
And you do a really nice job in this book of conveying that, that decisions made for the right reason, but even though it hurts somebody else.
Yeah.
It's a universal theme.
It is. And you want to, like, you want to do right by everybody in your family. And and sometimes you can't.
No.
And sometimes you just have to go with the utilitarian way, you know, where am I going to cause the least harm?
Right.
I mean, I don't know. My mother really did hold together, you know, six kids and all sorts of assorted other people who would, like, hang out and, like, live at our house. You know, she took in strays, literally took in stray human beings. And I don't know how she did it, because she did find that balancing thing where you never, like, I never felt unloved by her.
No.
Never felt jealous that she was, like, spending time with somebody else. Like, she was really good at that. But most people can't.
I mean, and I think you bring that up because you talk about, is it Theo that's hanging out with his mom? And she's like, oh, you don't have to sit here with me. You don't have to.
Bix.
It's Bix. Okay,
Bix.
You don't have to hang out with me. And he's like, but I like hanging out with you. And then he says, that's my mom's superpower.
Yeah.
Like, to credit to your mom, that people just want to be around
her
and spend time with her, whether or not they're related to her or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a gift, to be able to give that sense of presence to somebody.
Yeah. Making people feel like they're home when you're when they're with
you. Exactly. So, like, everybody fit in when they were around your mom.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a gift.
That is. And I think Grace, the mom in the novel, has some qualities of that.
Mm-hmm.
But she does make her mistakes.
Yeah, we...
But again, like you said, like trying to do the best thing that she can, but anybody here who's a parent knows that you do make mistakes. Like, you try. Like, if you get it right, like, 30% of the time, apparently you're okay. Like, your kid's not going to be screwed up. 30% of the time.
That's it?
I think. I read that somewhere.
Okay. It's kind of like baseball, right? Like, if you're hitting if you're, 300 and you're failing 70% of the time, you're, like, on the all-star team. So
exactly. If you're
we'll just
300,
use that logic.
Yeah, you're good. If you're only hitting 30% of the balls that come to you,
yeah,
bat 300 is great.
Exactly. All-star.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm thinking about Viola when I ask you this question, right? Because you're an artist in terms of writing and storytelling and sharing that with all of us. Do you think we're all artists and we just haven't figured out what our artwork is yet, or our medium?
Possibly, if we use a very broad sense of, like, what the medium or art is. Because, I mean, I know everybody's got, everyone has some really ridiculously unique little talent.
Mm-hmm. Mine is not singing.
And that's okay. But, like, I have this one friend who it's just like you want her with you at the grocery store. She has the unique gift. She can always find the most perfectly ripe avocado.
Oh, that is a gift.
Like not the mushy, not like when you open it, like when you peel it and it's like black.
Or not
inside.
The one that's like a hockey puck and by the next day it's already like the
mush,
really mushy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. So she's got like that gift for finding the ripest, the perfect avocado.
So she's the avocado artist.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, whisper, whatever.
Exactly. So I think that, I mean, is there an art to figuring out what, you know, what vegetable or fruit is perfect? Maybe. There's an art to it. There's an art to a lot of things. There's, you know, there's the art to being the baby whisperer.
Yeah.
Like you would see those pictures of like Obama and he would just like, every baby would just like stop crying when they put him in. Like, baby whisperer.
There you go.
I mean, I know he's maybe a bad example because he's got a whole lot of other talents, but.
Well, I mean, those are so obvious, those talents, so.
Right. But I think so. I mean, I'm not going to say everybody's got a novel in them because I'm not.
But like everybody has some, as you said,
everybody's
some
got a haiku
gift.
In
do you
them.
Think there's no way I could do a haiku? That's math.
You can count.
Barely.
Count.
No, I'm teasing.
You got enough fingers. It's okay.
I have enough fingers, but I'm kind of struck by that, and I think like these kids, their talent, their gift, unique gift, was discovered at an early age. I'm hoping it's not too late for some of us. To know what that is.
Yeah. I mean,
and figure that out.
It's too late to be a child prodigy, but it's not too,
too late.
Late
to be an adult prodigy.
Right? What's an adult prodigy? It's like, I'm going to be a savant. That's it. It's too late to be a child prodigy, but it's not too late to find your own talent.
Absolutely.
Or pursue your own art. Whatever, follow your bliss.
Absolutely. That's why, like, it's so great. There's so many things in this community. Like, Cleveland's amazing with the amount of things that you can possibly do and learn and see and experience, whether it's the Cleveland Orchestra, whether it's Playhouse Square, whether it's Dobama Theater, whether it's MoCA. I mean, there's just...
There's so much art. And if you don't want to be involved in the arts, then, you know, if you like history, go be a docent at like the COD or the Mather Steamship. I mean, there's
something
stuff.
For everybody.
Sometimes you have to seek it out, but
seeking
it out kind of helps us become more human because you start finding that connection to other people and to art and things that we create or your connection to history and your place in that. In that timeline.
So it comes full circle, right? About the more you experience, the more likely you are to figure out where you fit in with other people who share a similar interest.
Yeah, you just gotta explore.
Awesome. So I'm joined in conversation with Susan Patrone, local superstar writer. So final five questions.
Okay.
You could play any instrument, what would it be?
Surf guitar. Like I wanted to be like Dick Dale, like just play surf guitar. That would be awesome.
Favorite milkshake at Tommy's?
Chocolate and banana.
Ooh, good. Okay, so you mention in this book both classical music and pop music that the Mozinskis perform. What's your favorite piece of music that you can listen to over and over and over and never tire of?
Bach, Concerto for Oboe and Viola. God, what is... It's like the Adagio. And I can't remember, is that... It's like in B flat. It's just the most beautiful. The Adagio is like the most beautiful piece of music I've ever heard.
I agree. There's a lot of great music, and I found myself when you would talk about the music that they were performing, that I was immediately pulling it up so that I could listen to it while I was reading it.
I should make a Spotify playlist.
You should have a Spotify playlist. Okay.
All right.
Perfect.
I'm on it. Teach me how to make a Spotify playlist I can share.
Okay. We can do that. So we grew up roughly in the same era, right? Tiger Beat. Who was your favorite musician that was featured in Tiger Beat?
God. Rick Springfield.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Dr. Noah Webber.
Oh.
Oh, man. You know, he's not a bad little musician, man.
No.
He can bring it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And what book are you currently reading?
I am rereading Northanger Abbey because my husband, for Christmas, my husband gave me this really lovely set of complete Jane Austen, probably like from like printed in like the 20s. It's lovely. So I'm rereading Northanger Abbey because I forget how in some ways very modern that is, because it's such a great satire of Gothic novels, and she gets very meta because she's talking about, you know, she breaks down the fourth wall of books. So I'm reading that, and every night I read two of the essays in Ross Gay's The Book of Delights. That's like, I think everybody does, like, you knew medicine, just take two essays and call me in the morning. You'll feel so much
perfect.
Better.
Perfect.
Let me see, what else? I think that's it now.
The fact that you can read more than one is pretty cool.
Well, thanks.
I can typically read one at a time, or one fiction and one nonfiction.
Okay. But yeah. Oh, and I'm finishing, and I've been plowing slowly through Please Kill Me, an oral history of punk. So there's my nonfiction.
There you go. Perfect. So as we wrap up this evening, we have lovely people here and want to give them the opportunity to ask you questions.
Sure, if they have.
And I'll just repeat the question just so we have it for the purposes of our recording. Anybody?
I'm going to stay with the Bible book questions from the Times. but I want to start with the novel you hated. But let me go to the very last question. I usually print. Uh-huh. If you could invite three people to a dinner party, writers, living, dead.
Writers?
Yes.
Writers. Okay, three writers, living or dead, to a dinner party. Okay. Who would you invite?
God.
That's hard.
Jane Austen, Kurt Vonnegut, and my mom, who was a writer, and she would be delighted to meet both of them. And if I was tongue-tied, she would know what to say. Oh my God! Yes, actually, she and Kurt would totally get along.
Jane Austen,
Kurt Vonnegut, and my mom, because also it just would be nice to see her again.
So that's a great trio.
That'd be fun, yeah.
Yeah,
and we could eat falafel from Tommy's.
I was going to say, what would you serve? Falafel from Tommy's.
Falafel. I think Jane would be down with that, or broccoli risotto. She'd be like, oh, look at this. This is how that's like soup, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Anybody else have any questions?
Well, this isn't a question so much as an observation.
Yes, sir.
But one of the Mazinski children is named Bix.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, Bix, named after Bix Beiderbecke, the jazz cornet player from the 20s.
Yes.
Died of alcoholism at like age 25 or something like that. When I was a teenager, I worked at McDonald's in Brook Park, Ohio, and I thought I knew everything in the world, you know, because I was 17 years old.
You knew everything.
Yeah.
One of the managers of that McDonald's was a man named Jim. And Jim was weird for several reasons. One, he drove a Volkswagen. And two, on that Volkswagen, there was a bumper sticker that read, Bix Lives. And I'm 17 years old. I don't know who Bix is, but he told us, oh, well, he was this guy who used to play jazz cornet in the 20s. And we're like, okay, whatever.
Cornet? Yeah.
Grand Funk Railroad and Aerosmith. It was just the stupidest thing I could imagine. Somebody would have a bumper sticker on their Volkswagen about a dead jazz cornetist from 50 years prior. And once I actually grew up a little bit and got my head out of where it was, and this is a big spider back for the first time, I'm like,
oh, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Wait. I owe Jim an apology. And if I ever run into him, he's going to get that apology.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I love that you named one of the characters because it was like a little jab in my hand. Of course, you didn't know this.
How do you know?
It was like reminded me that, hey, you were a real clown 50 years ago. I argue that I'm not much less of a clown now. But I love it. It was really a cool thing.
Thanks,
yeah.
Man.
And yeah, look up, you know, while you're looking up the other things Susan said, look up Bix Beiderbecke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And listen to him play the cornet for about 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. If we had had a son, we were going to name him Bix. We adopted, so I have an Ella. We're like, Bix and Ella, like the jazz.
Oh my gosh.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Seriously. Yeah, in the form of activate.
How Bix is not like a name for people, like, what is wrong with people? Yeah. Why are people not naming their children Bix?
Yeah. I don't have go children, so that's my excuse.
Well, you know, y'all, anybody listening to this, if you're having a kid, name him Banks.
Exactly.
Son Banks.
I know.
Close.
Like Banksy. Yes. I just,
So thank you all so much for joining us this evening. Thank you to those who are listening. Thank you to Jaime and his amazing group for allowing us to hang in the South Campus at Cleveland Public Library. Thank you to our tech team, Brian, for making sure everything sounds all right.
Thank you, Brian.
Catherine, for capturing photos and memories. Mm-hmm. And I'm Jen Jumbo. Oh, Max Bax Books. Sorry, Max Bax Books. Carly, Max Bax Books. And all of you. So I'm Jen with Cleveland Public Library. Happy reading.
Page Count is presented by the Ohio Center for the Book at Cleveland Public Library. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and leave a review for Page Count wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more online or find a transcript of this episode at ohiocenterforthebook.org. Follow us on Instagram at Ohio Center for the Book, on Twitter at CPLOCFB, or find us on Facebook. If you'd like to get in touch, email ohiocenterforthebook@cpl.org and put podcast in the subject line. Finally, follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Laura Meline. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks for another chapter of Page Count.